go to, as I mentioned, we are looking at 1 Timothy as we've been making our way through these writings of Paul, these smaller epistles. And so we looked at chapter 1 and we looked at chapter 2, spent some time on chapter 2 there. So we're going to transition into chapter 3. And as we go forward, he's going to give some very specific instructions in regard to the leadership of the local congregation. Now, we introduced this section last time. I'll endeavor not to cover all that material again, but I do want to read it to begin with. So let's start at verse 1. This is, again, the English Standard Translation. So 1 Timothy 3 and verse 1, the text says, "The saying is trustworthy. If anyone aspires to the office of an overseer, he desires a noble task. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders, so that he may not fall into disgrace, into a snare of the devil." All right, so Paul brings up these qualities that an elder should represent. Now, the term used here is not elder, but is what? Bishop. Or, what's the other term? It means it's the same term, it's just a different word. Overseer. Overseer. So when you see the word overseer, it's the same term in the original language as bishop. They, you think of the idea of the literal translation as superintendent, somebody who tends to something, who's over some work. You might think about in the book of Acts in chapter 6 where they were told to select 7 men, right? And they give the qualities so that they may do what? They may be over this particular work of caring for the Grecian widows or the Hellenistic widows. You see the terms bishop, overseer. You also know them as elders or presbyter, right? We went over that last week. Again, all four of those refer to the same group of men. And then finally, you see in the Greek episcopo, which is the idea of shepherd, right? A shepherd or a pastor. That's the Latin translation of the transliteration of the Greek term. So that's where we get the word pastor. So those all six terms refer to the same particular group of individuals. Now, as we noted last week, he then begins to give us some qualities of this individual. But the first thing he notes right off the bat is what? That he should desire it, right? That if one desires a noble task, right? This idea of being an elder is a good thing. And it should be something that our men aspire to do. Our young men should be preparing themselves now to serve in that capacity. Our older men who have prepared themselves should willingly, hopefully, take that task on. So that kind of gets us to where we left off. So let's go to verse 2. So he then begins with this list of things here. So as we noted, desire is the first one. The second one you'll notice in verse 2 is what? That he is above reproach. The idea there of there's nothing glaring in his character that would bring disgrace upon him or the church, right? He needs to be above reproach. That his reputation should be considered and questions asked. And then it says he needs to be the husband of one wife. So really you see two qualities here. Number one, he needs to be a what? A man. He's the husband. He eliminates women even with just that one term there, that he ought to be the husband. And then he says the husband of one wife. In the first century, they had a huge problem with polygamy. And we in our country, that's not a huge problem for us, but there are other places in our world where polygamy is a thing that's ongoing. And so he says he needs to be the husband of one wife. You know, more than one woman cannot lay claim to him as their husband. And then he says sober-minded. Sober-minded. The idea here being what? You think of the word sober, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Not intoxicated.
Clear-minded. Yeah, somebody, go ahead.
Single-minded to the faith.
Okay. He's not a hypocrite, or what's the word I'm thinking of? I think I know what you mean there. But the ideal here, the literal kind of ideal, is that he is a clear thinker. He's not somebody who gets too high or too low. Right, he's not somebody taken to emotion, to fits of anger, or even fits of depression. He needs to be somebody who can think clearly in a difficult situation. Elders ever get handed difficult situations? They do. And they need to be able to step back and see the problem from a reasoned standpoint. Not getting too caught up in the emotion of the moment, or their own emotions, or the emotions of the other person. But they need to be sober-minded, not intoxicated by anything else. So he needs to be a clear thinker. He needs to be, the next thing you'll notice there, this is the English Standard Translation, is the word, the phrase self-controlled. You may see in your translation temperate. It's the same idea. Self-controlled, what's the ideal there? It kind of leans into the last one we just talked about. What's the image you get of somebody who's self-controlled? Who do you see? You hear that term? What's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Discipline your emotions.
Okay, discipline your emotions.
You said it, not too high, not too low.
Yeah. Can keep an even keel, right? He's also not somebody taken with their passions. I know this is closely related. It's a slightly different idea, but they're able to control themselves, right? Their passions, their emotions, their, you know, whatever it is, they're able to be mature enough not to allow their bodies to control them. They have control over themselves. Respectable, this kind of relates back to the first one, right? He's above reproach. But here in the English Standard, again, is the word respectable. Anybody have a different translation there after temperate or self-controlled? Prudent? Anybody else anything different than self-controlled or prudent? I'm sorry, respectable or prudent? I'm sorry, I'm jumping back one. Respectable, prudent, of good behavior. All right, again, you're going back to what is the outcome of their life? You're looking in a holistic kind of way at the person. Like when they walk into the room, what kind of environment are they creating? When they get involved in a situation, what kind of... what are they doing to the conditions of what's going on? When people look at their life, what do you see? Are they things that are godly and Christ-like? Or do you see something else? Yes. And absolutely. They're thoughtful about how they approach someone else. right? They're not trying to throw bombs into a situation to make it explode, right? They're not driving people away because they're unapproachable. That may be another thought here. The idea is they're approachable. And there's somebody you could feel like you can approach. Yes. Especially when you go back to self-controlled, right? Yeah, I agree. So, respectable. Next one. This is an interesting one here. And he's the English standard again here is the word hospitable. What is this one about? So first we need to really consider what it would have been like for the first century readers. So when they hear the word hospitable, what comes to their mind? What's the point Paul's trying to drive at with them? So let me give you an example of how this would apply. So we have hotels everywhere, right? We have two hotels. Well, one's going to be there eventually. We have one finished, another one's on its way, just right up the street. We have several hotels in town. First century, they have those? They didn't have those. Now, at most, they would have something akin to a bed and breakfast. But in general, when you traveled somewhere, where did you stay? You either found family to stay with, or you slept out on the ground. That was kind of your two options. And people who show hospitality are those relatives or those other people we meet who offer us a place to stay, who show us kindness in how we stay there. They're generous in that way. A biblical example of this would be Abraham. When he received the angels unawares, the angels came to visit. You remember what he does? He jumps up. He gets the household going to make a meal. Very gracious in receiving a guest. So that's the original kind of idea here, is this ability to be somebody who is kind in receiving a guest. Doug.
Mm-hmm. And they went to the center. Most cities have a central well, common spot. And I mean, in Boston, common. And you went there. The citizens of the city would see you there, and they should invite you. That was the general expectation. Mm-hmm. That you wouldn't let them spend the night at a well. You would invite them to your home and spend the night with you. We don't commonly do that today necessarily, but. I had an elder from Connecticut decided to try that on, if you will. He traveled from Connecticut to Washington to visit somebody and then back and never paid a hotel bill. The only person I've ever known of in the church that ever tried something like that to see about the hospitality across the country, but he never paid it. He stayed with a member of the church every town he stayed with.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that because I was thinking about this. Is I think sometimes we give people in the church a negative reputation here in saying that people won't be hospitable. I think it's more akin to what you're saying is we have become so, as a society, we've become so individualistic, so small in orientation that generally people visiting, do they come and ask for a place to stay? No, and I think, now I'm not saying this justifies the behavior, I'm just trying to explain why it happens, is I think over time, people have just become less open to going and saying, hey, come stay at my house. I'll give you an example. So even like when you, typically, when we have a visiting preacher, what used to happen? He'd stay at somebody's house. That doesn't happen as much anymore because I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm not trying to say there's some kind of moral right or wrong about it, but preachers a lot of times will say, I'd rather just kind of stay in a hotel. I can go and study and do what I want to do. And I want my solitude. Well, is that the fault of the congregation? No. And is it really a sin that he does that? Well, no, not really. But it is a loss of something that we used to have. And that ought to be thought about. So just something to think about. What are some other ways that we can show hospitality to people? Or how would this showcase itself in the life of a Christian living in this time period?
Invite them out to dinner.
Okay.
I mean, personally, me, I like to stay in my own hotel, you know, where it would be nice if the family, the church members would come in. When I went to Pat Shop, yeah, they did that. I like to go to sleep when I want to go to sleep. 7 o'clock.
Yes, ma'am.
I think of Jesus washing the disciples'
feet. Yeah, wow. What a sign of hospitality that was. Yeah, that's a good one. Luke chapter 10, the Good Samaritan, right? Just think of the changing attitude. And again, I'm not trying to make a judgment call, but just like a hitchhiker. Right? I'm not even saying there's not a good reason to not pick up a hitchhiker or to not hitchhike. I think there's some reason for it. But that's a change in our culture. It's been a big change in our culture where it used to be back in the, what, 40s, 50s, that we people hitchhike all over the place. But now, I mean, how many of us are going to stop? And again, I'm not trying to make a like moral judgment on it. It's just a change, right? Yes, ma'am.
I think like to that point too, just even slowing down, just in general, in conversation, in like we're as a society, I'm outrageously guilty of like always having to do the next thing and always having somewhere to be and someone else to answer to, and just taking 5 seconds even just to engage in conversation with somebody is a good way and an easy way that we can be hospitable in presence to somebody else today. You know what I mean? I think we're just so caught up in going that we
yeah. I think that's great, and I think that's exactly the kind of ideal. When you think of just like the bare bones of what would that look like, I think one of the ideals is giving people time, right, and giving people your presence. I think opening your home to people, even members of the church, you know, inviting them over, being, you know, somebody who's willing to take people out to eat, right? It's those little things we can do that can make a big difference in this idea. Well, it says elders need to be people who are hospitable. And I think all of these, as you start to think about them, there's such a tie that binds kind of all these characteristics of the personality that we're looking at. He goes on, he says, not a drunkard. Going, doing a little more research on this, I thought kind of interesting. That phrase may give us the wrong idea of what he's saying here. The phrase in the original language literally meant not to sit with or sit at the table with. That's the idea, the literal, if we were to just literally translate it, he's saying you should not even sit at the table with wine or strong drink. You shouldn't even be near it. So that idea is a little bit more strict than even the phrase not a drunkard gives. That there should not even be the association with alcohol, strong drink. And so he says he shouldn't be a drunkard. He goes on to say that he should not be violent. Instead, he should be gentle. And he gives this comparison between the two, right? In opposition to violent, he should be gentle. Isn't that pretty obvious? That one seems pretty straightforward. but he wants to list it. Again, you can combine this same idea with what other characteristics? Well, self-controlled, sober-minded, respectable, above reproach. There's a connection between all of those, but he just straight out says he should not be violent or given to violence. Again, control of your emotions, your passions, your person. You need to be somebody who is rather gentle, or you might have the word there, kind. But how do you approach people? Let's say there's a situation in worship. What's your response to a disruption in worship? Do you get up and go and angrily fuss at somebody that their child was a little loud, or that they were a little loud, or that they weren't doing this or that, or whatever it be? They sat in your seat. We laugh. It's happened. I also think it's important, we don't want people's first experience to be with us that we're getting on to them, or we're saying something mean, or maybe not even mean, but something very strong. If that's your first interaction with them, then probably you're not the one to do it. Right? Somebody who has a relationship with that person, we need to consider the ends of our actions. In other words, is what we desire greater than the harm we may do? Does that make sense? We might want something little and cause great harm to a relationship, to an individual, to the church itself. We ought to consider kindness and trying to be people who are kind. Lisa. And it is, but it's a work, right? And it's not perfection in any of these things. But we're looking overall, like what's the balance of the equation at the end of the day? What's the overall outcome of the individual? Do they have these traits in themselves? It's not saying we don't make mistakes. I know there's not a person in this room who's never said anything they wish they'd take back. Everybody in here has done that. Do you have a manner of somebody who's kind? Now, kind does not mean like you have to always tell people how much you love them and appreciate them. Now, that's nice. You need to do that occasionally, but it is your manner of tone and approach. And again, your relationship with that person.
Mm-hmm. Not the standard picture of the great, healthy man that American culture teaches. So you're talking about what the church is trying to tell women and young girls, young men, and their development. It may not be the same picture as the culture is trying to paint.
No, that's absolutely true.
You're basically fighting the culture and what the people and the children may be seeing and hearing among their friends and people outside the church, too. Our goal for a person is not the same picture in the American culture.
Absolutely. And A few years ago, we had the big attack on, and it's still going on, but it's not as out there, but the attack on masculinity. And this term toxic masculinity came up. Well, the one side, you know, wanted to change men into little sissies, if you will. I'm going to just say that term. We wanted to get completely rid of all masculinity. That's not right, and it's wrong. God created men to be masculine. But the reverse is also equally destructive. It is those who took on the masculine thing to its most, you know, to what in their eyes was the most strong and masculine big man thing. That's not right either. What Paul is shaping is a man of God. That's the kind of masculinity that we need. Not either of those two extremes. But as Doug mentioned, we need to build them. We need to try to teach our young men to be men who are shaped by the Word. So he says gentle instead of violent. Then he says this term, not quarrelsome. The idea here, again, the literal idea, was a little surprising to me when I went back and looked at it again. It's the idea of not fussing over words. I think maybe a better, in my mind, you can go and study it, idea here is not argumentative. The idea that you've always got to win the argument, even when there's no argument to be had. Anybody ever had someone in their life start to argue and about things that you weren't even talking about? You said, the sky's blue. Nope, it's kind of more purplish blue today. You know, this idea, they want to fight about everything. That's not a man we want to serve as an elder. You don't need to be argumentative, where everything has to be a fight and a struggle. That's not going to be productive.
Something's right, and you know they're wrong, but it doesn't matter, because why argue about it? I mean, it's not that important.
No, I totally agree, and we often, I'm talking general, and we argue about too many trivial things. We worry too much about things that aren't that important, and we need to be careful about that. We fight for what is God, right? Well, the things He wants us to fight for. The other things that are trivial, most of the time we can just let it go. So, good point. He does not need to be argumentative, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money, or the word there, greedy. Later in the same letter, Paul will say to Timothy, chapter 5, that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Right? Man's desire for wealth and material goods. A man like this should not be one given to those kind of desires. Not somebody who's chasing money all the time. Somebody who's always worried about collecting and material goods. He should not be greedy. Not a lover of money. Needs to be a lover of God. A spiritual manager of his household, or the way it's written here, he must, again that word must, do what? Must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. Paul makes it pretty clear to the Ephesians that in the home, the husband should be leading that home in a spiritual direction. And it's interesting that Paul will spend the most time on this particular subject of managing households. He gives us two different verses about this particular idea. Because he goes on to set up, if he's a man who cannot manage his children well, can you expect him to be a good leader of the church? He's already proven himself that he's not doing the job at home. He's not going to do it for the church. And so he needs to be one who manages his own house or his own children well, having them in all submission. In Titus's list, Paul gives to Titus, he says that the children need to be believers. So he goes on just beyond managing, but he's even able to teach his own children so that they are believers as well. So he needs to manage his own household. He says next that he must not be a novice or recent convert. Why would you not want a recent convert? Get puffed up with pride? It's highly likely that their spiritual education is not where it needs to be. Absolutely. Any other reasons? What does it mean, recent? Somebody define that. What does it mean, recent? See, Neil, people don't want that answer. They want you to give them a number. No, I agree. He doesn't define it for a reason. And it's just like our kids, ourselves, we all mature at different levels. We've got some young ladies who mature quickly, right? They grow up, they act mature in their teens. And we have some boys who get up into their 40s and they're still struggling with maturity. It's just the way of things. It's the same thing with our Christian walks. Some mature quicker. But he gives us a long list of other things that we look for. Right? This one comes at the end. You might have somebody who initially does all these things, but if he's only been a Christian a couple of months or even a year, have you really given him the testing time to know if this is really a developed character? We have to be careful about that. Yes, ma'am.
I think some of that mature in the faith ties in with able to teach.
Yes.
If they're not mature in the faith, odds are pretty high they're not able to teach.
Oh, I jumped right over that one. I'm sorry. Now that you say that, I was like, oh, I didn't see that. Sorry. I'll go back to that one. Yeah. Yeah. Let me go back to that. I don't know how I jumped that. So able to teach. The idea there, or what's the other translations? He's apt to teach. What does that mean? It's a kind of a short phrase. It's not linguistically, it's not a whole lot there, right? What does it mean to be apt to teach? Okay, first there's got to be an understanding. Yeah, Peter says that we ought to, we ought to always be ready to give a defense or a reason for the hope that is in us. This is a man who is ready and prepared to teach and willing to teach. And it doesn't just imply the idea that he needs to teach publicly. I think that's important. I think he needs to be able to teach a Bible class. He doesn't have to preach. But he needs to be able to sit down with somebody and explain the truth to them. And I don't just mean the plan of salvation. Why would an elder need to do more than just the plan of salvation? Man, you ever get hit with issues that are a little more complex and just a plan of salvation? And you got to be able to sit down with somebody across the table, or you know, sit across from them. You got to be able to open a Bible up and let's talk about this. Let's reason through the scriptures. So you need to have somebody able to teach. Thank you for reminding me of that, Melinda. And if his children are going to be believers, that's another sign that he's apt to teach, right? He's teaching his children at home. They're believing. I think you're right. The tie is there between them all. And then finally, this again kind of goes back to what we've talked about. He needs to have a good reputation in the community. Notice how it says. It says, verse 7, moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders, so that he may not fall into disgrace. I guess it would be the second one, but right there at the beginning you have above reproach, and then he comes back at the end. He needs to have a good reputation in the community. Above reproach in the church, but not just there, but in his neighborhood. How does he behave with those who are outside the church? It does matter. Think about things like Facebook. What kind of reputation do they have on Facebook or Instagram or TikTok or whatever you want to throw out there? What about at work, right? What if his coworkers think about him? Those are some questions that need to be asked and thought about. He needs to be mature in the faith and have a good reputation. I want to note just real quickly as we close out, he at the end of verse 6 and verse 7, he gives kind of the same kind of idea here. When he says that first, he doesn't need to be a novice because he might do what? You might become puffed up and fall into the condemnation of the devil. And then at the end of verse 7, he says that he may not fall into disgrace and into a snare of the devil. What's the ideal there? Let's take the first one first. We're talking about a novice and being puffed up. What's the condemnation of the devil? Pride. It's one of the attributes Paul has not directly come at until here. And I think that's the ideal here in that verse when he says that he might not become puffed up or to fall into the condemnation of the devil. What was it essentially that destroyed Satan? I think it's pride. I think pride. His arrogance took over his judgment and he did evil things. Now, of course, he sinned and did evil things, but I think the initial part of it was he was very prideful. And then what about the second one, that he may not fall in disgrace into the snare of the devil? What's the snare that he's talking about? I tell you, get caught. So I really think there's two ways to view this snare. It's the idea of him personally falling into a snare, kind of what Doug was saying, and Satan is wants to trap us in those things. And I think there's also a secondary thing here about the church itself. Remember, he needs to have a good reputation in the community, in those who are outside. There's nothing that will destroy a church quicker or evangelistic efforts more than having its leadership having a bad reputation of sin in the community. That will destroy the work quicker than anything. Because that's going to be the first thing outsiders say when you try to teach them. Oh, I know about your leadership. I know about your elders, your pastors. I've heard about them. And you can do great damage. It's bad enough when a member does that. But when a leader does that, it's even worse. All right, we'll stop there. Next week, we'll spend just a minute talking about the qualification of deacons. And they're very similar. You'll note the similarities between the two. We'll come back to that next week. Again, thank y'all for being here and taking part in this study.